As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to The View from the Lane, our Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. My name is Jack Pitbrook and I'm joined as always by James Moore and Charlie Eccleshare. Right now, if you subscribe to The Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any football fan this Christmas. Enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. Say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage for the whole year. It's the perfect present for yourself and someone else. Just go to theathletic.com/SpursPod, that's theathletic.com/SpursPod, and sign up. Tottenham are still top of the Premier League after their 1-1 draw at Crystal Palace on Sunday afternoon. So why are people being so negative about the game, Charlie?
Well, I don't think everyone is. I think there was a bit of a split on this. And I think even amongst individual people, there was a bit of a split. I mean, that's kind of how I felt. Like, on one hand, I thought, you know, it's a point away at Palace. It's definitely not a terrible result. And Liverpool drew as well, which makes it even less of a bad result. But I think the reason there's frustration is there was a nagging sense that it was a game that was there for the taking. And in the first half, it was impressive because I thought Spurs were, you know, a lot more front foot than they have been in the last few weeks. And they were more effective, really, than they had been in those in that Burnley, West Brom, Brighton trio of games. But I think it was the way it felt as if the initiative was lost in the second half and as though they sat off too much, were too negative and defensive, again, which I think, you know, fans are totally fine with if that's defending a 2-goal lead against City, 2-0 lead against Arsenal, or even just, you know, grinding out a well-earned point at Stamford Bridge. But I think the frustration was this really the right way necessarily to approach it? Though it was interesting because I put that to Mourinho afterwards, you know, why there was that drop-off in the second half. And he said it wasn't deliberate. They weren't, that was absolutely not what was said at halftime or before the game or at any point. He said, you know, you play with a low block against a team like Palace and they'll punish you. But he said they were, it was out of their control. Palace just played really well and pinned them back, which obviously raises different concerns. But I think he was at pains to say that this wasn't a, you know, we're going to just take what we have and try and sit on a 1-0 lead.
James, did you think watching it that Spurs chose to sit back in the second half like that? Or do you think they did get pushed back? And what does that tell you?
I mean, as Charlie says, Mourinho said after the game, it didn't feel as much like a plan as it did against Manchester City and Chelsea. It kind of felt to me like they were using the ball quite badly. I didn't think Son had an especially good game, which I don't know whether you could kind of say that coincides with the team actually having a lot more of the ball. I think there was it like 58% possession or whatever. So clearly that dynamic was quite different, despite being under pressure a lot in the second half. But it felt to me a bit like that, like I said last week about the second half of the Arsenal game, where they weren't defending badly at all, but it just felt like every time they won the ball, it just kind of hoiked up to the halfway line, where because Bergwijn is essentially in a team doing a defensive job, Kane, as we know, is now dropping back far deeper, is basically probably when Spurs are out of possession, maybe on like the kind of the edge of the centre circle in his own half, maybe. You're leaving just Son up the pitch basically to try and win the ball. And it just felt like, you know, Crystal Palace have several big defensive players in their team and they were just winning the ball easily every single time. And it was just coming back again and again and again. And I think, I've not actually done this, but I reckon if you watch back the goal, which I know came from a free kick, I wouldn't be at all surprised if in the 2 minutes before they gave away that free kick, Spurs probably won the ball like two or three times and hacked it up to halfway without any kind of plan, seemingly. It was like a classic example of one of those games where if you flip the entire thing round, you would feel totally different about it. Say, had Palace started well and penned Spurs in the first half an hour, created a lot and scored a scrappy goal, then Spurs kind of come good and played a lot of good football in the last half hour of the game and then equalised, you'd feel massively positive about it as a result and probably even a performance. Whereas obviously you kind of swing it round, you've gone 1-0 up against a team 11, 12 places lower in the league and then surrendered the lead and the initiative. It does feel like 2 points dropped. And you're right to mention that Liverpool then dropping 2 points later in the afternoon does kind of change the context of that quite a lot. And obviously Chelsea losing on the Saturday evening. But I mean, to me, that's all the more reason to kind of be a bit annoyed by it, really. It feels like it was kind of a preventable dropping of points. I mean, I imagine we're going to talk about, or people would want us to talk about, whether or not it's right or wrong to be quite so passive in a game like that, particularly in the second half. And regardless or not of whether it was an intentional thing, it definitely happened. And I do wonder whether, having played in that way for the last three league games, and obviously we know the league team and the Europa League team are totally different, so you can draw that distinction. I wonder whether it's quite difficult, like mentally and physically maybe, to kind of switch for one game to being way more offensive and dynamic, and then in the knowledge that you're going to have to flip back to playing the other way on the Wednesday evening at Liverpool. And particularly because we know, you know, that's going to be, whatever happens on Wednesday night, that's going to be an incredibly hard game. It's going to be an incredibly like chastening match, particularly for the defenders, and they're going to have to do a lot of work. I wonder whether there was a certain amount of like getting that lead and then just hoping that they could hold out and preserving a bit of energy and not kind of overexerting themselves going for a second goal. Because I don't think between going 1-0 up and the Palace equaliser, I think Gaeta made, what was it, one save?
Yeah. Spurs went more than 50 minutes without working the keeper, from around 35 to around 85. The only thing, Jay, I think you're really right about the difference in perception, and if it had flipped and they'd come back and, you know, rescued a point having been a goal down, we'd be saying that's a decent point to Selhurst Park. I think that's quite telling, though, in a way, because what frustrated a lot of the Spurs fans that I was seeing talking about this was the fact that it seemed like only once they'd conceded that goal did they really kick into gear. And so what a lot of people, I think, would have wanted was that, well, it shouldn't take that. You know, just because you're a goal up doesn't mean you have to, you know, revert. What, you know, and the fact that they did so quickly create those chances created a sense of, well, if we had just gone at them a bit more, they're not that secure and maybe we stood off them. But I think you're right about the change in, it's not easy necessarily having that change in approach. But that's actually why I was really impressed in the first half, because I thought the way, having come off those three games where clearly the approach was very much, right, we're going to sit off and pick you off on the counter, I thought it was impressive the way they actually created a bunch of chances in that first half. They had four shots on target, which was more than in the whole Arsenal game. They looked pretty positive, and I thought they looked almost surprisingly comfortable doing that. I was fearful that they might look a bit unsure of what to do against a deep line defence, and I thought in the first half they did that well. It was just a pity that the pattern of the game changed, but maybe it was, you know, as Jose suggested, you've got to give credit to Palace. I do think it did raise a couple of things. I mean, when you're winning games, it seems kind of churlish to, you know, point out things that haven't been working so well. But I think clearly there is, you know, teams are coming on to the fact that transition-wise, if you can stop the supply line to Kane, then Tottenham do struggle to move the ball up the pitch. And obviously a big part of that is because you've got Højbjerg and Sissoko, who have such a defensive role sitting in with Dyer and Alderweireld. And that does reduce how much they're going to be, you know, playing quick passes forward. And Højbjerg can do it. Sissoko, we know his distribution isn't that great. And it did feel in the second half reminiscent of the Chelsea second half, where they just couldn't really get out. And it's such a delicate balance, because if you sit that deep and you play with almost six defenders, that's fine if you carry that threat with Kane, with Son, with Bergvall on the counter. Once teams stopped that, as Palace seemed to do in the second half, there were times when it was just coming straight back and Tottenham were clearing it. And there was one, I remember, where Cahill just picked it up. And this would only have been in around, like, I don't know, 65th minute or something, but it did feel like a last minute siege at that point. So I think it's totally fair to acknowledge they've been on an amazing run and it's not a terrible result. But also, and this was the piece I wrote after the game, was trying to look at what are the things they can learn from this and try and improve on. And I think that midfield balance, it's just about getting that absolutely right. And maybe, you know, Højbjerg and Sissoko do just carry on for the moment. But I do think there will be games where they will be caught like this, because you are going to struggle to move the ball up quickly with those two, especially Sissoko, and especially if a team can shackle Kane like the way Kante did for Chelsea and the way that Palace were able to yesterday.
I think it's quite easy to categorise this game alongside, say, like the Newcastle and the West Ham draws, where Spurs really should have won and then threw it away at the end. But I do think in the Newcastle and West Ham games, they were just really unlucky. And like, they were quite random occurrences. And I think this game actually felt like the draw felt more deserved than it did in either of those two occasions. And that's why I've been feeling slightly negative about it, because it felt like this was more in keeping with what should actually have happened given the flow of the game. I don't know whether I'm just kind of unfairly writing off Crystal Palace and how well they came back into it, but there is part of me that thinks ultimately these are the kind of games that decide who wins the league. Certainly the last two or three years, the real strength of City and Liverpool has been winning so many of these kind of like quite difficult away games against decent sides.
Yeah, look, I mean, having drawn comparisons between this Spurs team and that Liverpool team of 13-14, who quite famously didn't win the league because they drew at Selhurst, having been in front. Yeah, it would be childish to not highlight that.
But I mean, also, just on that theme of like, were there other games where, you know, followed a similar pattern? I mean, I was looking at this and, you know, James and I, we always talk about the XG after each game, and it's now, Palace had a better XG. So fourth game running, Spurs oppositions have had a higher XG, and six out of the last eight. And I think, you know, Burnley away as a game could have gone either way. West Brom away could have gone either way. Brighton at home could make that case. So I don't think a result like this is a massive, massive surprise. You know, a result like this had probably been coming. And I did think, as you say, Jack, the equaliser, it felt like it was coming. But look, it's still, when you look at these, if you look at this game as a kind of, these five games as a kind of pack, and I know there's then three hard games after them anyway, so maybe it's a pack of eight or a pack of seven, including Leicester and Wolves. But of this first four, which was the kind of savage run of games, it's 8 points from 12, and that's really good. You know, I think everyone would have taken that. And even, you know, look at it in a more micro way, at the start of this weekend, given Liverpool had Fulham away, Spurs had Palace away, I think if you've been offered you're going to stay ahead of Liverpool after this round of games, you'd have taken that.
Totally. Look, I don't want this to be too negative, because it's not that bad a result. In terms of positives, Charlie, two things I want to highlight. I don't know if you've got any other favourite moments. Obviously, the Harry Kane goal was really, really good. And what I loved about it was it was such a low percentage shot, and you have to be so kind of confident and ambitious to take on that and to take a chance like that in the, like, suspecting that you can fool the keeper, and that's exactly what he did. So that was great. And then also the Tanguy Ndombele Rabona.
What a way to bow out.
I hope that wasn't a punishment substitution.
No, he knew he was going. There was okay. Already a lot of movement, and I think it was a kind of mic drop. I'll do this and then be on my way. Yeah, I mean, and good to see Son and Kane linking up as well. I mean, I know a few people were a bit sniffy, saying it's not really an assist, but it goes down as an assist. And this was what I was looking at pre-game, was their relationship and kind of how they get on off the pitch, and quite a few little nuggets in there of them driving to the airport together for away games and now sitting next to each other in the dressing room. And there's a sense that they've, you know, got a really close bond. So they're now, they've got 12 assists for one another this season alone. And the record, Sheeran Sutton's record for a whole season is 13. That was over a 42-game season. And obviously, So Son and Kane are almost certainly going to break that record, and we're only, what, 12 games into the season. It's pretty extraordinary. Yeah, I mean, I think it was one of those games. I don't even think you need to, even if there weren't even tons of kind of individual positives from the game, I do just think it's one where you look at the bigger picture and say, you know, two goals conceded from seven games, five wins, two draws from seven games, top of the league in December. It's all, you know, it's nothing to get too frustrated about. But I also think, though, it's fine to also say, well, yeah, the overall context is great, but there are some things to improve on, because the way you win titles is by learning from games where you drop points. I mean, and Spurs are a good example of that. Look at, you know, there's such a clear line in the sand. They drew 3-3 at home to West Ham and conceded three goals in the last 8 calamitous minutes. They double down from then. They completely change the way they play. They have Sissoko and Højbjerg playing as almost centre-backs at times, and they go on this run of conceding 2-7. That's what you have to do as title-challenging teams. So what will be interesting is to see, well, how do they adapt from here? Do they keep doing exactly what they're doing, or do they make slight alterations for equivalent games? And Anfield on Wednesday may not be too revealing in that regard, because I don't think what happened against Crystal Palace is really going to change the way they approach. I don't think they're going to be any more or less gung-ho. I think we know how they're going to approach that game. But maybe it does subtly change how you approach, say, Wolves at Molineux or Leicester at home on the weekend.
Yeah, so Wednesday night at Anfield, looks like it could be one of Spurs' biggest league games in years, really. I mean, I know we're only 12 games into the season, but it's first against second in the Premier League. It's chance for Spurs to open up some space between them and Liverpool if they win, and I know they obviously don't have a fantastic record. And Phil, James, have you got any optimism for this game, or are you too scarred by Spurs' recent record?
Not especially confident in broader terms, but you do kind of quite fancy that Spurs will be well prepared for this game. And I, like I said earlier, I kind of think what happened on Sunday afternoon may have been partly because at least one eye was on this game. We know exactly how Spurs are going to play, and we know exactly how Liverpool are going to play. And we saw in January, when I think it's probably safe to say Liverpool were in a better quote-unquote moment and Spurs were in a worse quote-unquote moment, that Spurs did a pretty good job of frustrating Liverpool and keeping them at arm's length for quite a lot of the game. Obviously lost that 1-1-0 without Harry Kane in the team. Or on Dombley, I imagine. I can't really remember now, blimey. So yeah, I mean, you'd kind of fancy that there's an opportunity for Spurs there. I mean, Liverpool obviously have done incredibly well without the players they've had missing in the last few weeks. And I know Hotto is missing, isn't he? He's going to be out for a few weeks, so he won't play. And obviously he's probably been their form player maybe in the first couple of months of the season. So I suppose you'd have to say that was a boost for Spurs. But, you know, clearly they're still an incredibly good side. And it is, unfortunately for Spurs, for the second time in a week, probably one of those grounds where 2,000 fans actually will make a difference, rather than it just feeling like, you know, just a very small number of people rattling around a massive stadium. You can be fairly sure at Anfield, I don't know, it's a horrible cliche, but at Anfield under the lights in a big game, 2,000 people will definitely feel like more than 2,000 people.
Yeah, well, that said, we've talked a lot about how there are some teams who Spurs play who are perfectly set up for Spurs to attack in behind. Like, you know, Saints and Manchester United are the two obvious examples. Like two of Spurs, and Man City, you know, three of Spurs' best four performances of the year really were in those games. And one thing we know about Liverpool is they do defend really high up the pitch. Like, maybe not quite so high up the pitch now that Van Dijk and Gomez are injured. You know, now that it's Fabinho and Matip, I think they play a slightly more pragmatic game. But they're still like a totally like front foot team who defend high and leave space. And, you know, you saw how much joy Ademola Lookman had yesterday sliding those passes through in behind for his Fulham teammates. And I just think they are... I'm not saying I think Spurs are going to win, because it's tough, but I do think that there could be the opportunities there for Kane and Son to get in behind if Spurs can, you know, find the right pass to midfield. It's going to be a huge game, I think, for Ndombele, for example, because of how much pressure Liverpool put on in midfield and how relentless they're going to be. I don't know whether Kate will come back into the team or not, but it's the kind of game where I think it will be attritional, but I think there's the opportunity there for one moment of magic from Ndombele or Højbjerg or whoever. If they can slide in a Kane or a Son, then it's, you know, Tottenham could be in.
Well, that's where what I was talking about before and the issues they've had in moving the ball up the pitch, certainly yesterday. You know, if they can do that against Liverpool, as you say, but it's a question of how much Sissoko and Højbjerg will just be focused on the defensive side and protecting that back four, because there will be chances. I mean, even against Arsenal earlier on in the season, Liverpool, when I think Van Dijk was still playing, in fact, I'm pretty sure he was, that was the game where Roy Keane questioned the big open spaces they left him behind, which, you know, with better finishing, Liverpool could have dropped points then. Obviously, Spurs are a immeasurably better team than that Arsenal side. So there could well be chances. I mean, I was thinking about this, and like, if Spurs win this, it'll put them 3 points clear of Liverpool against a team who haven't lost at home for more than 3.5 years in the league. Would this be Tottenham's best ever win in the Premier League? Is that overstating it? I mean, James,
are you harking back to my piece about that Man City game? Is that what this is?
Well, that wasn't even best. It wasn't that kind of most influential and changed everything. But
definitely was one of the better results to go away to someone good and win. I mean, that's not something Spurs have done loads.
No, but this is like an era-defining team that have won the Champions League and the Premier League. That was a transitional team under Mancini.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this would be better. I mean, well, I suppose you can kind of only really say that once you know like what it's meant and the kind of the context has all become evident. Because if they won on Wednesday night, then lost to Leicester, and then ended up kind of falling down into third or fourth place or whatever through the second half of the season, then maybe it doesn't feel quite as significant. But obviously, if they win and then win a title, yeah, I think you probably look at that and say it probably would be the most significant result and the best result.
But just as a statement, like it just in the moment for them to go and win, I mean, like imagine how that would change the conversation.
Yeah, it would be massive. It would be totally massive. I mean, I don't think if Spurs won that game, I don't think there'd be anyone left in any doubt that they were in the title race. As much as I've made it abundantly clear that I don't think the title race is a thing you can really talk about until sort of February or March, but whatever.
Yeah, I was trying to. It's funny you say that, Charlie, because I was looking back through. I was trying to think like, when is the last time Spurs had a game this big? And you can look at. I was thinking of, because even in 16-17, Spurs were always so far behind Chelsea that even like when they famously beat Chelsea in January that year, which is an incredible win, it didn't massively like change the dial in terms of the title race. And so you're looking back to the 15-16 season, that, you know, the famous Arsenal game in March, the West Ham defeat in March. But that was March. There was like 12 or 14 games left in the season. And now we're only 12 games into the season. So I don't know how much we can. On the one hand, it does feel like a huge game. On the other hand, we are really, really early into this season, aren't we?
It is incredibly early. But like Charlie says, it is an opportunity for like a statement. And especially if you do open a gap at the top, which obviously they haven't been able to do up to now. I mean, an actual points gap. Then, I mean, look, it's a massive week, isn't it? And we'll touch on the Leicester game, I'm sure, in a minute. But like, if they can get 4 points from those two games, they'll be top of the league at Christmas, whatever happens in other games. And whichever way around, they get those 4 points. And I think, you know, although Christmas is coming earlier in the season this season, I guess, we'd normally be about halfway, I think it would still be quite a big statement to be like ahead of the pack at that stage. Without wanting to dwell on negative memories very quickly, I know you mentioned that West Ham game, Jack. I would say actually I'd forgotten about that, but that was a significant one because that, I think they could have won. If they'd won, they would have gone top of the league in March, wouldn't they? Obviously, they didn't go top of the league that whole season. And famously, it was Arsenal that bottled it, not Spurs. Just want to just put that out there again.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And then, of course, on Sunday, it's Leicester. Spurs beat Leicester very comfortably when they came to Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in July. But that was a diminished Leicester team. And Charlie, they're looking really dangerous, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine them being as, say, naive as... I mean, they were a bit unlucky. It was quite a weird game because they were actually quite good for the first half hour, Leicester, and then just got blitzed in the way that... It was actually, that was quite, that was one of the first times we got an indication of that kind of the way Spurs were going to play under Mourinho that effectively, because Kane was brilliant in a deeper number 10 sort of role, and they just, they sat deep and picked Leicester off. So you'd think they would learn from that, but maybe not. And maybe it's one of those where it's just quite difficult not to fall into those traps. But it's a weird game to preview because we could be talking about it, you know, as Tottenham having, you know, a 3-point lead at the top and over Liverpool anyway, and kind of, you know, roaring towards it, or it's about can they bounce back? But yeah, whatever the situation in that Liverpool game, that it's another big test in this run of really, really challenging games.
Do you think there's any prospect of maybe a slightly different approach because of Vardy? I mean, you don't really want Vardy running in behind Toby and Dier. Do you think there's any chance he might go back to Sanchez, or are we just overthinking it? James is putting a face.
I'm putting a face. I just can't see a world in which you put a guy in who has only played in European games in the last, 2 months now?
Right, yeah,
And even then has looked quite rusty. I mean, against LASK, if we're calling them that, then, yeah, I think he looked really bad in that game, didn't he? The 3-3 draw. I mean, he looked like he got caught out a couple of times, and you just think, like, chucking him in against one of the best centre forwards in the league would be risky. I completely see the logic.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I don't know whether, like, Joe Roden maybe would be another option. But I would be surprised, Mourinho, I'd be surprised if he kind of changed that. That would be the one thing I think he'll want to keep, that defensive partnership.
Yeah, definitely. And I think he'll do what he's done in the other games of trying to compensate by dropping Sissoko and Højbjerg in. And I do think that is an issue. James and I were talking about this earlier. Like, Sanchez is that loss of form. That has meant they've changed the way they've played. And I think, Jack, we were talking about it as well. The fact that, you know, in an ideal world, you'd probably have Sanchez in there for his pace, but he's not playing well enough. So you have Darren Alderweireld where there is that lack of pace and you have to compensate with the midfielders. But that does create a hole sometimes in midfield. And we'll see, you know, maybe a team like Leicester or a team like Liverpool, that will cost them. But I'd be amazed if he changed that partnership, Darren Alderweireld, who have such an understanding, and, you know, with Spurs on a run of 2 goals against in 7.
I mean, you know, the whole thinking of having that defence sat so deep is to kind of negate the risk of players
exactly.
like Vardy being able to run through, right? So, I mean, I maybe wouldn't be entirely surprised if you saw a situation where Vardy didn't get too many chances, but perhaps perhaps Maddison is able to pull the strings in midfield. So, like you say, Charlie, it could kind of flip that dynamic a little bit.
Taking these two Premier League games together, because then after then it's Carabao Cup and Stoke City away, what do you think Tottenham would be aiming for? Would you take 3 points? Would you want 4 points? What's the level?
I think you'd definitely take 4. I think you'd be pretty crazy not to take that, given that that would, you know, a draw at Anfield and a win at Leicester, or obviously the other way around. If you were offered 3, would you take it? I don't know. What do you think, James, if you were offered that?
In a similar vein to what I said about flipping that Palace game around, I think if you lose at Anfield and you play okay, and then you beat Leicester at home and you play well, then I kind of feel like you're going to come out of that week relatively happy. I mean, I can't work out where they would be in the table if that happened. I guess
depends on other results.
There you go. They'd still be at least second, wouldn't they? I guess, because presumably
unless Chelsea could, because Chelsea couldn't close that gap enough, could they? How many points did Chelsea?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Everyone's really close, aren't they? It's too hard to work out. There's too many permutations. I kind of think, you know, that does seem incredibly defeatist, particularly when you're talking about, well, when you are talking about a title challenge. I mean, I think there's certainly something to be said for, like, bouncing back of a win after a defeat. I mean, if they won at Anfield, then lost at home to Leicester, it would be incredibly annoying. I mean, like I said before, if they can get 4 points from those two games, I think that would be absolutely incredible. That would be spot on.
Elsewhere in Spurs' world, they've been drawn in the last 32 of the Europa League. when I saw the draw, I thought, oh, cool, Wolfsburg, we can do a big bit about how it's the former team of Kevin De Bruyne and Aidan Dzeko, and they're on the way back up in the Bundesliga, and, you know, they used to be managed by Wolfgang Wolf, and they're sponsored by Volkswagen and all the rest of it. And then I realised it's, in fact, a team that I've never heard of called Wolfsburger, who are, in fact, Austrian, not German. This is completely destroying my credentials as someone who claims to know about European football.
I had only heard of them because they were in the Europa League group stage last season with Wolfsburg and Wolves.
Oh,
and the
yeah.
suggestion was that it would be like incredible if they were all in the same group, but unfortunately...
Imagine the banter, yeah. But so these guys, this is their third ever European campaign. It's their best ever European campaign. Everything I know about them, I've learned off their Wikipedia page in the last half hour or so. Charlie, have you read anything else, James?
Have you spent more than 30 minutes reading this Wikipedia
page? Yeah. Did you think it was kind of like one of those fake Pro Evo names at first? Because they didn't have the rights to Wolfsburg, so they just slightly tweaked it to Wolfsburger.
Trad Brick.
Yeah, the Trad Bricks. They, Merseyside Red, etc. They are seventh in the Austrian Bundesliga, I believe. I mean, you know, and given the way Tottenham navigated... Well, I mean, they won comfortably at home. I guess they drew away with LASK, didn't they? I don't know a huge amount about this team. I mean, from people who know far more about them and European football than I do, the reaction seems to be they've done pretty well with the draw here, Tottenham, especially bigger picture. It looks like quite a few of the decent sides left in the tournament have drawn each other, which is quite handy. I mean, one of Sociedad and United will go out, which is good. One of Benfica and Arsenal, who knows what state they'll be in then, is good. And also that means Vertonghen and Adelterad returning to North London, which is quite cool.
Yeah, I think most Spurs fans are probably more excited about that Arsenal Benfica draw than the Spurs Wolfsburg draw, and I say that now under full expectation that I've cursed it and Spurs will lose. But you know,
so that's
will be
Thursday, 18th of February, away in the Lavantal Arena, and then Wednesday, 24th of February, an unusual Wednesday night second leg fixture, presumably for kind of fixture congestion and policing reasons, back at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. I'd love to say that I'm hoping that would be a well-attended game, but it's literally impossible to predict what the rules will be on matches and attendance and fans and everything more than 2 months down the line from here. But fortunately, it is like sufficiently far away that hopefully things will have improved by then. Also, Charlie, this week, you've spoken to former Tottenham Hotspur manager Tim Sherwood. How was he?
Yeah, he was really good. So I was speaking to Tim. He's part of the Amazon Prime team. Obviously, listeners will be familiar with Amazon Prime from the All or Nothing documentary, and they're showing Premier League games in December. So yeah, we were talking a bit about Spurs now and about his time at Tottenham. I mean, I was thinking back, we did a podcast, didn't we, on his time at Spurs, which was really fun, kind of reflecting on that pretty action-packed period. And you can listen to that if you missed it at the time. What would it have been, like May, April, that kind of thing? But anyway, yeah, he was interesting. I mean, we talked about, you know, his time at Tottenham, and he, you know, I think people know that he feels he did a good job. He feels he always told it like it was very upfront, and that didn't always go down well in kind of modern football, but he wouldn't change anything. I mean, we talked about, you know, the future for him as well, and whether he'd want to be a manager again, and he said he wouldn't change. He would continue to shoot from the hip and say it as he saw it, and maybe that would count against him. But he talked well about you know, some of the players who he played with. I mean, there were some he fell out with, and you know, there were issues over their attitude and approach and that sort of thing. But he said, you know, Christian Eriksen was the best player and also the best trainer. He said Sigurdsson was a really good trainer.
I mean, Christian Eriksen, for instance, was probably the best player we had and had the best attitude. You know, couldn't fool him at all. Eriksen was one. Sigurdsson was outstanding professional. They're great. You know, players, for someone like me who's come from the development side, for young kids to look at them too as professional footballers and the way they worked every day to improve themselves, and Harry Kane, who was coming through, would watch them and be out with them and join in the shooting sessions and the three kicks and the practicing what they did over and above the time we had with them on the training field. It was just a great example.
So it was interesting kind of reflecting on that period, and I also asked him about comments he made in the December after he left Tottenham, saying that Jan Vertonghen was a really good kind of ball player, but he couldn't defend, which he denied. So we had a little bit of an exchange about that.
And one thing I wanted to ask you, you once said about Vertonghen that he couldn't defend. Is that something you stand by? Do you think that's fair?
Vertonghen what?
That he couldn't defend. You said he was great on the ball.
I never said that.
You did.
No, I never.
You did. I promise you. In December 2014. Never. What do you think of Vertonghen?
I think he's a very good player, excellent player. I would have still had him at the club. I think he should still be there.
And he talked about AVB and kind of what he said that was quite interesting. He said when he came in, there was a feeling that Tottenham were playing really boring football under AVB, and so he wanted to go in and change things up a little bit, and you know, just do something different, be a bit more exciting. And you know, it did. We talked about it when we did that podcast. It did work for a bit. That kind of shock therapy. They won some games very entertainingly. Beat Southampton away in his first game. They went and won at Old Trafford. But obviously, yeah, then it didn't quite work out. But also, just you know, looking back on you know, what we were talking about, the you know, this forthcoming game against Liverpool.
Well, I see it playing out that Tottenham City defend very deep. Liverpool have most of the ball, and Tottenham rely on Kane and Son to do some magic as they've done. I mean, what they scored, I think they scored 23 goals all season, and 18 or 19 of them have been shared between Son and Kane. Liverpool have all of the ball. Tottenham will try not to let them break them down. And hopefully Tottenham can expose them on a counter-attack.
What would your prediction be?
If Liverpool take their chances, they win the game.
Yeah.
Because they will have more. But it's all if, buts and maybes. Mm-hmm. Harry Kane and Son, they don't need many chances because they're so clinical. I mean, even in the North London derby, and we're not talking about... I mean, they're a poor team, Arsenal. They're not Liverpool. So... And they didn't have that many chances, Tottenham. Certainly in the second half, they're sitting back too much. I think it'll be a draw, and I think Tottenham will be happy with a draw going to Anfield with the record they've got there. But it's hard. It'll be a fantastic. If they got a draw, it'd be a fantastic result. If they obviously get a win, it'd be a magnificent result, and it would be more than 3 points. It would be a confidence boost and a reminder and a marker down to everyone in the league that Tottenham are realistic title challengers.
And he was full of praise for Mourinho and the job he's doing. He talked about how they have a kind of... What Mourinho's done is he's created almost like a cartel of players who are absolutely on side with him. He talked about guys like Højbjerg, who's kind of his captain on the pitch, obviously Harry Kane, and just getting the buy-in of all the key players, which I thought was interesting.
No, but Jose just gets the players. I mean, he does exactly the same now at Tottenham as what he's done at Chelsea when they were very successful. He's getting players to buy into his methods. You know, he has a cartel. He's got a cartel there now. He's sent the message out to them guys, and they're buying into the methods. Now it's the time, when the fans come back, for them to buy into it.
And then he talked a bit about English managers, in his view, not maybe getting the opportunities that foreign managers get, which many will disagree with. But yeah, it was very interesting to chat to him. As we talked about on that podcast, he's someone that divides opinion. A lot of people think, you know, he was too outspoken as Tottenham manager and remains too outspoken, but he's really good to talk to. You know, he's talking to us from Amazon Prime. He's working as a pundit for them, and yeah, they're showing a bunch of Premier League games this December, including Liverpool Spurs on Wednesday.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price,
Priceline.
One other thing that I wanted to mention on this week's podcast, which I've been thinking about a lot, is Jose Mourinho posted on his Instagram a photograph of his chairs. He has these two custom-made chairs by a company called Secret Lab in his office at Tottenham's training ground. These are the Secret Lab Omega brand, one of which is Game of Thrones branded. Now, I've never watched Game of Thrones, but I'm told that it has the branding of the House of Stark, who my colleague Carl Anker tells me are stoic, moral, and fiercely loyal. So they've got Ned Stark, who is played by Sean Bean, who apparently gets... So I'm going to spoil Game of Thrones now for you. I'm sorry, listeners. But apparently he gets decapitated at the end of season one for being too honourable.
Ah, oh, for fuck's sake. Well, what if I was going to watch that?
This was years ago.
Can I just say, I've started watching The Sopranos, and I know you're a big fan of The Sopranos, and I'm about to talk about that in a minute. Can you not spoil The Sopranos, please?
Okay, promise. I promise I won't spoil The Sopranos for you. And then the other one is The Dark Knight. Guys, I don't know what you think about this, what you think the... Game of Thrones and Dark Knight chairs tell us about Mourinho.
I mean, they are like a sort of 14-year-old boy's chairs, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they are.
I mean, looking at those pictures, all I can think of is like the smell of a 14-year-old's bedroom, which maybe the less said about that, the better.
I have to say, I think that the... I can't talk about Game of Thrones, but I do think that Mourinho having a Dark Knight chair is just perfect, because I imagine that, you know, that famous sequence at the end of The Dark Knight is basically how Mourinho conceives of himself. Like, this idea that in a corrupted world, that a good man will have to do bad things to get results. And if that means he's hated by other people, then he's brave enough to take it. And part of his Mourinho's strength as he conceives it is his willingness to embrace a dark side and to accept all the criticism, and reveling in that sense of martyring his own image. You know that bit? It's like Mourinho is saying, I am whatever football needs me to be. I imagine he watched...
He's an anti-hero.
Yeah, he would... I can totally see Mourinho watching The Dark Knight and thinking, yes, this is exactly my vibe.
How do we think Mourinho would have felt about the previous Batman films? I mean, presumably he would have hated the kind of that Batman Forever, Batman and Robin era, but maybe he would have quite liked the Michael Keaton ones.
Yeah, too kitschy. Yeah. Too kitschy, yeah, for Jose.
Jose does have a big kind of mischief to him.
That's true.
Like mischief and...
Glint in his eye.
Like taunting and wordplay and that kind of thing is...
You think he likes Jim Carrey as the Riddler? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe. I do think there's kind of lightness to amidst the dark, I think, with Mourinho. I think you're absolutely right, Breaking Bad. I can totally see him. I can totally see Mourinho loving Breaking Bad, because Breaking Bad is obviously so, so popular with some men, or lots of men, and particularly the kind of Breaking Bad fan who, like, just sees it who sees the show quite simply as, like, how one clever, ruthless man came from nothing to build this amazing empire. You know, the kind of bad fan, as they're known, of Breaking Bad.
I can have to word this question carefully, because I don't want to suggest that Jose Mourinho might cook meth. which Spurs player would be the Jesse Pinkman to Jose's Walter White?
I was thinking about this, and I wonder, it feels like there has to be an arc to the story, doesn't there? And they have to rub each other up the wrong way and be in conflict for a lot of the time, but there to be some affection. So I wondered if someone like Ndombele, who they started off really, really not liking one another, it seemed, but they've found a common ground and a way of working together, and they now...
It's mutually beneficial.
Yeah, well, they now feel like a partnership. And, you know, who would have thought that Pinkman and White would form that bond? And likewise, we thought this maverick midfielder and the kind of veteran, experienced manager, but they've managed to find a way to do it. So I think it would be someone like him.
So are you saying it's all going to end with, and this is a massive spoiler for Breaking Bad, by the way, so forgive me, with Jose Mourinho being terminated, let's say, and Tunguy Ndombele escaping? Is that what you're suggesting?
I guess eventually they will both leave, yeah. So yeah, the parallel works perfectly.
I can also see him liking Narcos.
Yeah, definitely, 100%.
Like, quite a kind of, like, glitz. I really like Narcos, but it's quite a
simple, like glitzy, glamorous, dramatic show about a charismatic, powerful bad man. Like, it's good. Like, I think it's really well made, but it's
again,
very Marine.
Anti-hero again. Yeah, you can see it.
The anti-hero, like Walter White or the characters in Narcos, like those kind of anti-heroes don't have the depth of like a sort of Tony Soprano type.
Wasn't it Pochettino? He was a big House of Cards fan.
Oh yeah, yeah. I can definitely see Mourinho like
that.
So well.
Yeah, because I always thought yeah Mourinho would admire the Frank Underwood kind of Machiavellianness.
Do you reckon he likes the Sopranos?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, for exactly the same reason. Tony Soprano, it's an anti-hero, right? It's exactly the same. You can just see he could see himself in Tony Soprano.
If he'd be a character in the Sopranos, who'd he be?
I've told you, I've watched two episodes.
So you watched two episodes, okay. I'm going to say Johnny Sack. Just because kind of stylish, like quite on the surface, he can be reserved, but then also like with like spasms of emotion and anger. I'm not giving anything away, James, by saying that, but yeah, I've always seen him as a kind of Johnny Sack, I think, more than Tony, just because Tony has a kind of, I don't know, maybe it's just a physical thing. It's because Tony's such a big guy and he's got this kind of garrulousness and stuff, and I've never quite seen him in Mourinho in quite the same way.
What do you think Mourinho will watch on Christmas Day? Will he watch Gavin and Stacey?
I'll probably watch like videos of how Wolves defend set pieces.
Should be careful about what you say about Gavin and Stacey, because I reckon that's an incredibly... I really hate it. I mean, I've never seen it, but it looks shit. But I reckon it's an incredibly Spurs programme. So we should be careful about what we say.
Well,
about
actually,
Gavin,
yeah, Gavin's a big Tottenham fan, but both the actor Matt Horn and the character Gavin.
Yeah.
I really like in these pictures, the Batman ones are like reasonably natural in a way, the way he's posing with them. And then the Game of Thrones ones, he's like sitting out, looking at what looks like an empty pitch. It looks like weirdly unnatural. You'd think they could have found a way of making it look like, yeah, this is, you know, as if he, are we meant to think he just sort of sits there like that of a day? Just gazing
out. Can I give an explanation? What I think is an explanation for why he's posted this. And this came up on my brother's Instagram feed last night. I'll read the message. So look, hashtag secret lab, make nice chairs. Comfortable, looks great. Great price for a premium product. And here's the thing. They'll extend my warranty if I post this. So here we are. Hashtag I'm sorry. So I put to you that Jose Mourinho has posted that to get an extended warranty on the chairs.
Wow.
There you go. Another big story exclusive for the Athletic.
I imagine it's been a big day for secret lab because now, you know, Mourinho's got... I don't know off the top of my head, but I imagine millions of Instagram followers who are now familiar with Secret Lab. Like, I was looking at the chairs myself. So they've been reduced from £379 to £344 in time for Christmas.
Like, if you're gonna almost literally hawk your backside around like that, then I am also looking for a chair. So if they want to send us some free chairs...
I actually just bought an office chair. God, what an idiot, given that Secret Lab are about to send us some incredible chairs to use. It's fine, you can still do it.
Was it Game of Thrones branded?
It was Dark Knight, actually.
And you won't even need that warranty.
On the other hand, it's possible that we're all completely overthinking this and he just really likes, like, Big Bang Theory.
I know, yeah, or just Friends. Maybe he's a really big Friends fan.
Yeah.
That kind of...
Who do you think is his favourite? Who's his favourite?
His favourite Friends character. I reckon maybe Joey. I know that sounds ridiculous, but in the way that Jack was saying before, he does have that kind of mischievous side to him.
I can see him just sat there earnestly watching Friends, being like, this guy Joey, he's hilarious. And like, WhatsApping the rest of the Spurs team his favourite clips from Friends. But who knows? Okay, I think that's probably as good a point as any to bring an end to this week's podcast. But thank you very much if you have made it all the way through this nonsense at the end. We will be back again next week, by which point Spurs will have played Liverpool and Leicester in the Premier League. So we'll know a lot more about the strength of their title challenge by then. If there's anything else you'd like us to discuss then, please just tweet us. Thank you very much to James and Charlie and producer Tom. And we'll be back again next week.